Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is two doctors answering the internet. Specifically, these are questions from my Instagram, Ask Me Anything. We're going to talk about soreness. We're going to talk about an over-the-counter PED, nutrition training in medical school, lifting for those on GLP-1 receptor agonists, and much more. But if you like this type of content, consider signing up for Barbell Medicine Plus. You get access to a private forum where you can ask us questions. We have dedicated Ask Me Anythings, Ask Us Anythings with Dr. Austin Baraki. We do those routinely. You get early access and expanded samples of our new programs, exclusive content like articles, videos, and more. Plus, you get to support the work that we do here at Barbell Medicine, all for about the price of a cup of coffee. You can find out more at barbellmedicine.supercast.com. I've linked that in the description below. On the other end of the line, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. Routine day in the hospital today, and that's about it. So ready to tackle some questions.
Now, if you're listening to this, you can't see this, but if you're watching on YouTube, you've already picked up that Austin and I are apparently matching today. We have the same color shirt on. It was unplanned. We did not coordinate our outfits, but apparently we're team green today. So
sometimes that happens.
The two Hulks. Before we get into this podcast, a few announcements. We still have our two-day live in-person seminar for our pain and rehab content. That's May 17th through 18th in Buffalo, New York. I've linked that in the description below. It is worth CEUs, continuing education units for physical therapists, for athletic trainers, personal trainers, et cetera, strength coaches. You guys can all use that. If you're just a person who's interested in this type of content, it'll be useful for you in your life. You can check that out. Again, that's coming up this, I guess it's still spring in Buffalo, New York. We also just released our second generation Strength 2 and Strength 3 templates, a lot of cool programming stuff in there. So if you're in the market for a new program, you can check that out. You can try it for free on our app, which is also free. You get a free week sample, or you can do that through our website if you just don't want it on your phone. You can do either way there. And then there is a new training video of me training my dad. I released the first one about a week ago, and I released the last one. When this goes up, well, it'll be earlier this week, so you guys can check that out. It's my dad deadlifting and doing some step-ups post-knee replacement and a few other stuff. Other things going on. Any announcements for the that you want to make, Dr. Baraki?
No, very legit that your dad is squatting and deadlifting and stepping up on the knee. He's feeling good overall, yeah. I take it?
Oh, yeah. He's loving it, loving life. He's just a character in the gym. Like, just imagine the most influencer-y gym that you've ever been to, that as you've trained in my gym, you know that to be the case. It's pretty high up there. We got the lights. We got the, you know, it's just a minefield of tripods at the gym. But I like it. The equipment is great. The people are great, whatever. But Leonard is just, I feel like he's overwhelmed, like overstimulated, just too much going on.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Yeah, he's like, and he always keeps asking me, he's like, what is that person doing? I'm like, I don't know, Dad. Let's just focus on the task at hand. You get another set of four. Come on.
Cool. I had a patient encounter in the hospital this past week where I got to demonstrate and do a little bit of the usual motivational interviewing around strength training for the patient, because it was an older woman who came in with pretty significant hypercalcemia. Her blood calcium level was around 16 or so, which is pretty high. She had symptoms from it. We got that all fixed up with some medicines, but it was the result of essentially a side effect of a different treatment that she had been trialed on for the treatment of her osteoporosis. And so that fed into a subsequent conversation of, well, what else are we doing besides using medicines for osteoporosis and kind of doing a little bit of education around that and getting her on board with the idea of putting some force through her bones to get them to adapt, and that it's okay to do that. One of the things that I feel I've become pretty passionate about around the topic of osteoporosis in particular is how it's discussed, because a lot of times patients are told things like their bones are brittle or prone to fracture and things like that. And that's partially true, but not in the way that we want people to understand it. Rather, you know, in terms of we certainly want to increase the bone density and robustness of your bones, but they are not brittle, quote unquote, to the point where it is unsafe for you to exercise or to, you know, perform loaded activities like strength training. And so the way that we discuss these topics with patients is pretty important. So I use that as another important teaching opportunity, because it's pretty easy for us to just casually say things like that, that end up planting seeds in patients' minds that, oh, they told me that, you know, my bones are like paper mache, and if I do anything that they're going to, you know, break, which is not accurate. So another important aspect of communication and a good teaching case this past week.
Your bones are underloaded, have been.
Yeah.
Need more loads. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you want to talk about my hip? You want to?
Yeah. What's going on with it today? And you want to fill the people in on the past few days?
Yeah. So I started prepping for, if you guys, this is your first Barbell Medicine podcast, just skip the next like 3 minutes. This is not important to you. This is a personal story. I've been preparing to do a national level powerlifting meet because I'll be masters this year. And I thought, oh man, chance for glory. Let's go. Competing at nationals is one thing, but the idea was, oh, maybe I'd have a chance at actually competing to win and subsequently go to worlds. That's mm-hmm. like the whole thing. And unfortunately, this is on a yearly basis. So you have to do well at nationals to qualify to go to worlds. And then obviously you still want to be strong at worlds. When I signed up initially, I had been having this off and on kind of hip pain, just non-localized, widespread, hey, it hurts at the bottom of the squat. Not every squat and not every time I trained and whatever. So I was like, well, it's probably going away. It's resolving. But subsequently, the last 3 or 4 weeks when the train loads got much higher and, it actually started to matter what the weight was on the bar, it became more prominent and kind of came to a head this past week. I was supposed to basically do my last heavy squats and last heavy deadlifts. And my last heavy squat, I felt something in the hole of the squat, but I still was able to stand up with it. And I've torn that adductor before. And that was, you're not standing up with anything with the completely, torn adductor. Although it turns out it was only a partial tear and the tendon was fine. But this particular time I stood up and I was like, it doesn't feel good. I'll just go lighter on my back offs. And I thought it was fine until it came time to deadlift later on in the week. And honestly, I couldn't really pick up. I mean, my best deadlift's in 750 range and anything 375 was, it's not that it was heavy. It just hurt a lot anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So long story long, at this point, that was basically a couple of days ago, and this is supposed to be the week of the meet. I was like, if I can't squat like at least 315 without pain, pain-free, I don't know that's a good idea to do the meet, because knowing myself, I can't just go there and I'm going to squat 315 and I'll bench something heavy. Like what? I don't want to travel across the country to do that.
Sure.
I mean, 135 was gnarly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it took everything in my brain, like positive self-talk and it's going to be fine and you're okay. And it's not like I was, going to die at the bottom of the squat. It just was like, this is very uncomfortable. And I was videoing myself and I was squatting. I went to 225 after that and I was squatting it high, even though I was like trying everything in my power to get to depth. I just wouldn't let myself do it because I'm like, yeah, it's going to hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, frustrating situation. And you gave me a call in the aftermath of it, and we had a chat about what you're experiencing and what the wise strategy is moving forward. And unfortunately, these things don't really care about competition schedules when they happen. And and I think given the big picture quote unquote stakes that are involved over your competitive career time span, then it sounds like we moved to try to be smarter with this, rather than trying to force something.
Yeah, the biggest problem is that Masters Nationals is like 8 weeks from now, right? Mm-hmm. And so in my brain, I'm like, all right, best case scenario, like a 3-4 week rehab, like everything went exactly as you planned and like, okay, now I can train. That only gives me 4 weeks of training and I just don't feel great about that. Also, the last like few months, I've kind of been on this like singular focus of I'm going to a powerlifting meet. It actually matters. I'm pulling out all the stops. I'm going to live this monk life and do it. And
yeah.
It's just frustrating, man. I don't know what else to say other than like, it sucks.
Yeah. So been there. I know the feel. And I think that you described it well when you go monk mode and you're singularly focused on this thing.
Yeah.
Especially something that is as monotonous as powerlifting, right?
Totally.
And I don't mean monotonous in a super negative way, but rather it's just like structurally a monotonous activity
of
the same three lifts and like pretty close variations of it, which sets people up for a relatively high incidence, I think, of like just overuse syndromes when they're pushing towards a performance goal, right? Not so much of people are just like, I'm recreationally doing this for general health, that they tend to be less frequent, but pushing high loads, high volumes, high frequencies towards a goal. And then along the way, when you have those kind of niggles that come up here and there and you say, it'll probably get better and you keep going, sometimes they do. And sometimes you end up kind of digging yourself into a little bit of a deeper hole, which, sometimes luck doesn't go your way. I did remember, on the call when we were chatting that as frustrating as it is, one of the first things actually that I thought about was when you dislocated your shoulder.
Yeah.
And that was a much more obvious, like acute sudden thing where you're like, oh, I'm done for a while, right? Like there's not like, oh, let me work around this kind of thing, right? And knowing that you fully dislocated your shoulder, then, you know, I remember the video that you put together of the way you came back from that and worked back up to a, you know, 200 kilo bench press. And I've had my share of, you know, tweaks and strains and tendon things that have had me have to deload all the way back to the bar at varying times. And of course, the timing was not necessarily right before a meet, which adds to the level of frustration. But I think trying to zoom out, especially at this stage in your training career, and recognizing this is a long-term deal, that there's really nothing preventing you from, you know, fully rehabilitating this and moving some heavy weights again.
Yeah.
But maybe going about it in a different way might be wise next time around.
Yeah, I have no concerns about, like, will I ever be strong again? Will I ever be able to squat or whatever? That's the real thing is, I don't think in the best case scenario, everything goes my way, I could squat 600 pounds in 8 weeks, which is unfortunate, you know, like that's the bar, right?
Yeah.
So, it's just frustrating. And I kind of feel a little dumb in a way, like mainly because, like, I was training intelligently. However, if I had to do it all over again, probably beforehand, I'd be like, you know, my hip, it has been kind of talking to me off and on a little bit. Like, is this the best decision?
Sure.
I don't know that I would have made a different decision, you know, without the benefit of hindsight here, because I would have been like, well, I'll just maybe include some more variation.
Right.
Or I'll, you know, it'll be a little lighter, or I'll do some more rehab-y type stuff. And who's to know, even if that would have modified my course here, it's all the effort and resources, like, you know, towards this singular goal, it just feels like a waste. So
yeah, I feel you, man. Sucks.
Yeah, maybe I'll be a bodybuilder for a couple weeks. So after 225, I was like, yeah, all right, I'm going to scrap this. I didn't even try to deadlift because I was like, this is stupid.
Yeah.
So I went to the pendulum squat, and if I take a narrow stance, and it's probably just too parallel, it, like, just because the stance is so narrow, that's tolerable. A hack squat's a no-go because it's just too much external. Yeah. It's sensitive. A leg press is fine. But you know, interestingly, the worst feeling one, can you guess? It's a unilateral exercise. What's the worst feeling exercise I did today?
I was going to say either some form of a split squat or like a Cossack, like a lateral lunge kind of thing.
Oh, I didn't even try a Cossack. God, I would.
I bet that would have been rough.
I did step ups with like just body weight only, like a lateral step up. So anyway, I know what I'll be doing. It's just, you know, so anybody who is looking forward to a potentially mediocre finish at Open Nationals, with maybe a better finish at Masters Nationals, you guys are going to have to wait another year, I guess, and so will I. And I'll have to come to terms with that. That's fine. Maybe I'll be more chipper on the next podcast. Anyway.
Yeah, in that training, you can how about maybe if you need some more supervision, you can run your training decisions by me week to week, and I'll be the intelligent decision maker on the other shoulder.
Yeah, and it's not AI, it's human. Yeah, human intelligence, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, let's get into some of these questions. We're going to start off with a banger here. We're going to talk about the best ways to prevent soreness. So this question was actually longer about, you know, how do you prevent soreness from like BJJ, CrossFit, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And I just simplified it to best ways to prevent soreness from training, because I don't know that any specific modality, like type of training, has a unique sort of like, oh, we'll do this in this specific case. So we can just talk about soreness more generally. And so I believe that this individual is talking about delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS. And this is pain, stiffness, and tenderness in the muscles that starts in the hours following a workout, peaks within 24 to 72 hours before gradually subsiding. Now, there's still a lot of uncertainty around the mechanisms, like what causes DOMS, though it is pretty clear that loaded eccentric exercise is required. That's exercise where the muscle is actively lengthening, so like the downward phase of a squat, for example, or a bench press. New exercises and or higher training loads likely increase the risk and severity of DOMS, though age and sex don't seem to be related. So it's highly likely that anyone who is serious about training or who regularly engages in formalized exercise, they're going to experience delayed onset muscle soreness. If it's happening all the time, that suggests that the training load, likely volume, the proximity to failure, and or the intensity, so the amount of weight that's being lifted, are too great for the individual. Some usually a combination of all of those things. And if somebody never experiences delayed onset muscle soreness, it's probably likely that their training load isn't high enough to sort of get all of the potential gains they could have from engaging in exercise. Perhaps paradoxically, so continued training, even when you're sore, can reduce the severity of DOMS. So that's not really preventing delayed onset muscle soreness, but more of like a symptomatic or therapeutic treatment. You can call it therapeutic exercise if you like. So when faced with the idea of like, how would you prevent DOMS? That's different than treating it, right? When you start thinking about prevention of people getting sore or reducing the severity of soreness, what do you start thinking about, Austin?
Yeah, there's going to be probably I'm imagining a scenario where I'm working with somebody and they're like, that's their main concern is wanting to prevent soreness. And so I think some conversation would be in order at that time point to set some of the expectations that you just mentioned of like, well, what does soreness mean to you? And I expect somebody who's asking that might be like, well, the last time I tried to exercise, I got so sore that I was like laid up in bed and I couldn't move for 2 weeks. Or maybe it was so bad that they actually like got rhabdo, and then that's what they mean by sore. It's like, yeah, okay, there are different ways to go about this. But just any soreness at all is not necessarily something that you need to prevent altogether, especially when you're starting to do something new. If it's something that's tolerable, does it limit you in the subsequent days? I would, you know, try to reset some of those expectations, but I'm not trying to just like gaslight this person either necessarily and like, you know, brainwash them into saying that this is never a thing that you're going to experience, but rather that it's just a kind of an expected response to a novel training stimulus or some of these other variables that you mentioned. It reminds me a little bit of our conversation on the last podcast episode around IBS and like FODMAP diets and sensitivity to where two people might have a similar, you know, amount of distension in their gut and one person might experience it as a little bit more unpleasant than someone else. I feel like you or I, if we do some training and we get sore, it's almost like a borderline enjoyable kind of sensation in the next day or two, because it's like pretty uncommon for us to experience it at this point. And so there is this kind of subjective experiential aspect to it. And so if you're able to reframe what soreness means to you, like, oh, it means I at least likely got a reasonable training stimulus from this session. That's not to say if you didn't get sore, you don't get sore, that you're not getting a reasonable training stimulus. Mm-hmm. But so there's just some initial conversation at play. And then the rest of it comes down to if we want to mitigate it as much as possible, then I guess the idea would be adjusting the dose and the novelty of the training stimulus to be as like small and incremental as possible. Mm. If I was like new to training and I was like, I don't ever want to feel a bit of soreness during this whole training journey, then like your first session is going to be like a set of three with the bar and then that's it. You're done for the day, right? So making the increments and the dosage, starting it super low and incrementing it super slowly, I think would probably be the best way up front to like prevent feeling soreness if that was your goal at the outset.
Yeah, I actually think that maybe there's like an expectation continuum here, right? So if you're maybe a preference continuum, so if your preference is to never feel sore, I think that you're likely going to leave a substantial amount of fitness-related adaptations on the table because you'll never get close to like your maximum training load that you can tolerate. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of that spectrum, if you're like, I must feel like crazy sore after every workout, because that's the only way you know that it's working, I think you're actually out kicking your coverage more often than not. And you're also going to be a little stymied there. And so you'd want to be somewhere in the middle. You'd want to be, sometimes I'm sore and sometimes I'm not.
Yeah.
When I think about prevention, I just kind of automatically try to come up with different categories for like risk factors that I think would actually increase soreness. So I think about extrinsic factors, intrinsic factors, program specific factors, and environmental factors, just broadly speaking. So extrinsic factors would be things like sleep. So sleep deprivation, for example, we know that people tend to report or have signs of an increase experience in training stress if they're sleep deprived compared to that same training if they are not sleep deprived. So if somebody was going through a phase of like sleep deprivation, sleep restriction, whatever, life stress was real high and causing some sleep related issues, that would be a time to concomitantly reduce total training load, like maybe as a preventative or prophylactic strategy there. Another extrinsic factor would be nutrition. And the two major ones here are just total energy intake. So like if it's Ramadan, for example, maybe that's not the time for your highest sort of training load, because we do worry about total energy intake if it's not available to you. Or if somebody's in like a dieting phase, it is possible that if they have like a pretty significant energy deficit that, you know, they're just run out of total calories to support their activity levels. I don't really know that that's going to happen in resistance training too much, but I think about like more endurance focused activities, people trying to prepare for ultras or marathons or something like that. And they're also trying to lose weight. It's like, you really just need to feed your activity level at this time. It's probably not the greatest time to lose weight. And then protein would be the other one. There's pretty good evidence here that if there's a protein insufficiency, that people will report higher levels of soreness, which is exceedingly rare in modern societies, particularly in the United States. We just tend to eat a pretty high amount of protein, even if it's not as much as you need to like maximize gains. And so in the research, once people get up to that 1.4, 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of total body weight per day, I think people can check the box for protein. Higher than that may be a personal preference, and it may be better for some like muscle-related outcomes like muscle mass, muscle strength, muscle preservation perhaps in a cut. But like if you're eating less than that and you're sore pretty regularly, that is kind of an easy fix if you can stomach the protein and the price of it. Intrinsic factors, I start thinking about mood. So some decent evidence regarding anxiety and depression, and it seems to correlate with more severe experience of DOMS. And so I could think about, you have a person who has a, no sort of mental health issue, right? And they're running a training program and they're off to the races. They're thriving. Yeah, things are going great. And then they develop major depressive disorder, for example. And they're like, why am I sore all the time? It's like, well, this is multifactorial. Like you're just maybe more sensitive to that same sort of training stimulus like you talked about earlier with IBS. And so they feel more soreness, experience more soreness. Or it could also cause other effects with nutrition. Perhaps they're eating less. They might be sleeping less. Mm-hmm. And so it could be more complicated than just the mood itself. It could have other knock-on effects. I think about program-specific factors. You talked about this already. So new exercises, the like more novel on exercises, particularly if it has a pretty big eccentric component. Yeah, that's a recipe for increased soreness, especially if the amount of reps, sets, and total training load is high, and then even more so if the proximity to failure is pretty close. So I can imagine a situation, I'm trying to think of an exercise you haven't done in a while, Austin. I'm thinking overhead press. You don't like overhead pressing, for example. Although maybe that's not a great example because there's not a lot of eccentric there. So maybe what is an exercise that that you don't necessarily do a lot of that has a long eccentric?
I've been doing super varied training recently, and it's actually been more challenging to find something that gets me sore. Yeah. I mean, I imagine like if I flipped the question and had you do like sissy squats loaded on a hack squat machine or something like that, that's probably a fair amount of eccentric load across the quads that you're not used to handling. Or like if I had you do reasonably heavy like single leg dumbbell RDLs or something like that that you're not ready for, that would be another example.
Yeah, long eccentric, taking it all the way to failure, close to, significantly worse than a more moderate amount of volume and a little bit further away from failure. So you would probably initiate a person, their first experience to these exercises, first exposure would be less total reps and sets, staying further away from failure, and then you can gradually increase that over time as the person's able to tolerate it. And yeah, training status is another big one that's program specific. So if a person is very, very well trained and has had a wide variety of different exercises that they've had exposure to, there's some transference of this thing we call repeated bout effect, the RBE. Basically, that suggests that people get less muscular damage to an exercise that they've already done. And there seems to be some transference between similar exercises. So, for example, squat. A regular squat with no pause is one type of exercise, whereas a pause squat is a different type of squat. And I would expect there to be good transference with respect to like muscular damage that you would experience from those two exercises. So the more trained a person is, I would expect the less soreness. So just like you kind of basically just said, you're like, dude, I've been doing a lot of weird stuff. So try to make me sore.
Right.
good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck. The last thing I think about here, just as far as major factors that would be generalizable to most folks, is the environment. And I don't, mean necessarily like, oh, what gym did you train at? But if it's really hot, for example, or the environment is harsh and so hydration status becomes an issue, those things would all tend to increase soreness and actually increase risk of like rhabdomyolysis, so exertional rhabdo, and then also like heat related illness too. So if you're in a hotter environment, maybe you live in El Paso, Texas, and your gym is not air conditioned, for example, that might not be a great time for your highest volume, highest training load sort of session. And then you mentioned underlying medical issues. I was going to see if you came, if you discuss this. You want to talk about metabolic like issues or like,
I mean, I'm imagining, I've seen patients before who maybe they're not habitual exercisers, but if they have kind of this subacute or chronic kind of muscle aches or disproportionate muscle aches or soreness in response to trivial amounts of activity. I remember admitting an older lady once who was just doing her routine housework and she was getting super sore, and she came in and we actually found out that she was in rhabdo. And we were like, tell us about this housework. And it actually sounded pretty routine, not terribly high effort. And she ended up having a myositis. She had a condition called polymyositis, an autoimmune attack on your own muscle cells. And so there are a variety of underlying muscle conditions that can increase the risk of this kind of thing or predispose you to it. And I don't say this to have anybody who feels sore to go get tested for a bunch of these things, but rather if it seems very disproportionate, or if someone has recurrent episodes of rhabdo that don't seem to be, again, proportionate to the stimulus that they have been exposing themselves to in training, I do start to wonder about muscle disorders, myopathies, myositis, mitochondrial conditions, especially if they're young, or certain medications that can increase the risk of muscle disorders like this. So there are some underlying medical things to think about, especially if it's, again, disproportionate or recurrent severe episodes of this that you wouldn't have expected from the novelty of the activity or the dose of activity.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Good feedback. We discuss delayed onset muscle soreness and more in podcast episode 298. I've linked that in the description below. This podcast is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. One of my goals this year was to learn a new language, picking up from where I left off last year with French. I've been consistent with getting to Rosetta Stone at least 3 times a week, usually when I'm doing some sort of steady state cardio. And I've been very impressed with how much better and how much more confident that I'm getting. It really feels like it's starting to pay off, and hopefully I'll get the chance to try it in France once again. Now, whether you're traveling, advancing your career, or just love learning, speaking a new language in 2025 is a great goal, and Rosetta Stone makes it easier than ever. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere. I use the app while I'm doing cardio most of the time. It's super convenient. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Barbell Medicine listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off now. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. They say that money can't buy you happiness, and while that might be true, money sure can make you feel a lot of other things, like stressed, guilty, and overwhelmed. I've definitely been there before, and it's like when you're not in control of your money is in control of you. Acorns is a financial wellness app that helps you take control of your money with simple tools that make it easy to start saving and investing in your future. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You also don't need to be rich, and you don't need a ton of time. Acorns lets you invest with spare money you've got right now, as little as $5, and start investing in just 5 minutes. Basically, Acorns does the hard part so that you can give your money a chance to grow. Financial stress can certainly play a big role in health, and Acorns gives you small, simple steps to get you and your financial wellness on track. Are you ready to take control of your money? Sign up now and join the over 13 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $22 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app today to get started. This is a paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. This podcast is sponsored by Factor. Factor is a meal delivery service that provides nutritious, healthy meals that are dietitian approved and chef crafted. They're delivered right to your door and ready in just 2 minutes. And I've been using Factor meals a few times a week when I'm really busy with work, and I can't say enough good things about them. Eating well has never been this easy. You just heat it up and enjoy, and it gives you more time to do what you want. They have over 45 weekly menu options. You can pick the meals that fit your goals. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause and reschedule your deliveries at any time. I was recently traveling and rescheduled an order to be delivered the day I got home. It was super easy, and I didn't have to go to the grocery store right away. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. Get started at factormeals.com/BBM50off and use code BBM50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code BBM50OFF at factormeals.com/BBM50OFF for 50% off plus free shipping. This podcast is sponsored by Wonderful Pistachios. Now, I've been a Wonderful Pistachios customer for a long time prior to them coming on board, as I'll typically use their no-shells honey-roasted pistachios in my morning oatmeal, and then have some no-shells sea salt and vinegar as a healthy fat source for a meal or snack in the evening. Wonderful Pistachios come in a number of other flavors, as well as different sizes for taking with you on the go, and they also have unsalted versions, which holds the sodium but not any of the flavor. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids. Like other nuts, pistachios are known for their protein power, their fiber content, and better-for-you unsaturated fats for a combination that may help you feeling fuller longer. Whether you're running between meetings, dropping off the kids, or need something on the way to the gym, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack. All right, let's move on to the next question here. This is a good one. And I'm not just saying that. I know sometimes I do that. It's just like habit. But this, I like this one a lot as well. This individual says, I have bad congestion and occasionally take Sudafed. Can I train? Is it dangerous to take on comp day? So maybe potentially yes. Maybe potentially yes, dangerous to take on competition day depending on where you're competing, like what organization. So this is pseudoephedrine. That's Sudafed. This directly stimulates alpha adrenergic receptors in your nose and in your respiratory mucosa, also in your and beta adrenergic receptors in the bronchial tree. Basically, when people take this, they have like a stuffy nose, if they've had a cold, if they got sinusitis, allergic rhinitis, stuff like that. And yeah, helps you breathe better, decrease mucus production and all this other sort of stuff. Now, all of that's well and good, can be therapeutic in those settings, but it is prohibited in competition use. So if you're subjected to WADA testing, it is prohibited to use in competition. You can use it outside of competition. You don't need a therapeutic use exemption, a TUE, to use it. Like, look, if you get a cold in training or whatever, and somebody pops up at your gym to test you, like whatever, you don't need a therapeutic use exemption for that. But if you get tested at your meet, you could potentially pop positive and have a higher level. There's like a threshold level. I think it's 150 milligrams or something like that in the urine. And so then you would apply for a retroactive TUE. But there have been reports of people who have tried to do that, but their level was so high that they were like, nah, bro, you're tested positive. You got a 2-year ban for taking Sudafed. So maybe dangerous, not from like a health risk standpoint. It actually, there's actually some decent evidence. I didn't expect to find much on this, but they have taken a lot of like healthy people, giving them Sudafed and then had them exercise or do some sort of a performance thing and see like what happens. And so, yeah, it increases your heart rate in healthy individuals, but it doesn't really increase performance. It seems to be about half the amount of performance increase people get from taking caffeine. So whether or not this should be on the banned list is a whole other thing. I think WADA and their rules and stuff is more about the potential abuse, which people can and do for a Sudafed. I think the bigger risk I think about is, why is somebody taking this? And further, like, is it a good idea to be training in a public place if it's something that's infectious, from like a public health risk? And I don't know, how does that strike you? Do you think I'm like being overly cautious, overly risk averse, or what?
Yeah, this is a person, whoever asked this, is somebody I'd want to have a bit more of a conversation with them about, to get a sense mainly of the nature of their symptoms and especially its chronicity, meaning how long it's been going on for, because Sudafed is not a drug that I would recommend somebody use for chronic nasal congestion. The most common cause of chronic nasal congestion is just going to be probably regular old seasonal, you know, allergic rhinitis, which has much better and safer treatments that you can use long-term to manage chronic nasal congestion from allergic rhinitis. But if it's not allergic rhinitis, then there are still other things that can make you have a sensation of congestion in your nose that would be worth detecting, certain like polyps and other sorts of things that would be worth taking a look in there, right? But there's no situation where I'm recommending somebody chronically use pseudoephedrine long-term for something like this if it's not been evaluated or figured out why the person's experiencing it. So that would be my first recommendation, is like, hey, have you tried other better and safer medicines for allergic rhinitis before using something like this? It's interesting you mentioned that there's even a modest performance benefit, I guess, from stimulant effects. I'm also curious, I'd be curious, you know, when they do their drug test, are they actually directly testing for pseudoephedrine, or is it that this drug cross-reacts with other things that also have stimulant type effects, other things from the like ephedrine family? That would be not surprising to me as one of the ways that you could pop positive from just cross-reactivity with from others. And then the last thing I'll say is pseudoephedrine is the type of Sudafed that I believe has been moved to behind the counter, quote unquote, because it's something that has been used to synthesize meth before. Whereas now, if you're getting something just off the shelf and it's labeled as Sudafed, it's often now labeled as Sudafed PE. That is phenylephrine, which is not the same as pseudoephedrine. And phenylephrine is also an alpha, you know, receptor agonist, but it is worthless for congestion, for cough, for cold, for symptomatic management. There was actually some new guidance, I think, within the past couple of years. I believe it was from the FDA on the general worthlessness of phenylephrine for cough and cold remedies, yet it still tends to be sold and is available over the counter. And so I don't recommend anybody use phenylephrine pills, oral systemic pills of phenylephrine for anything. There are other uses of phenylephrine if you give it in other ways. Usually it's going to be in a hospital setting, so you don't need to worry about that. So, yeah.
Yeah. It says under WADA's rules for this that pseudoephedrine is prohibited in competition when its concentration in the urine is greater than 150 micrograms per milliliter. Now, again, to your point, I don't know what exact metabolite they're testing for, but the way that reads to me, I'm like, are they testing just for pseudoephedrine or it's like known metabolite? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
The last thing I had here, so if somebody was taking this, they had like a cold, right? This is another question I got separately. We'll just lump this together. If someone has an active cold, it's likely to be caused by a virus, you know, if it is in fact a cold. And so any post-viral syndrome that people can have after they've had a viral infection can increase the risk of myocarditis, and that's been pretty topical recently. I don't know. If somebody's got a pretty gnarly cold and they're like, should I train? And I'm like, public health risk aside, I think it's likely to be fine, you know, just common things being common. Some people are going to develop myocarditis. I just don't know that exercise – while somebody has these symptoms actually does increase the risk of myocarditis. I think it's one of those things that's either going to happen or it's not, regardless of what you do. However, you might identify, in fact, that you do have myocarditis by exposing yourself to exercise, because otherwise you wouldn't know. At least that's how I'm thinking about it. Does that make sense to you? Or?
Yeah. I mean, that's a hypothesis. I find it plausible. It's infrequent enough that this is not certainly not a great concern for me. I think when I get asked this to your point, it's, are you training in a public gym with an active, you know, febrile illness or something like that, where you're spewing virus everywhere? But if you're training by yourself, like you and I have both trained when we felt under the weather, I think that most of the time we tend to adjust our sessions to a greater degree in that situation, because it's just recognizing, like, I might just mentally or to some extent physically prefer to be active more than not. Yet I also recognize that my body is not in the best position to adapt to a stimulus right now. And so hitting a max effort set or aiming for a particular weight load on the bar or something, that's not necessarily the point of this session, but rather just to move around a bit and feel good. It's okay to sometimes do that. And so that's usually the path that I take, because I, of course, have maintained a garage gym for a long time. So it's straightforward, even when I don't feel awesome, to get out and move around a little bit. But I'm usually not loading terribly heavy because the stakes are not usually very high. I'm not usually a week or two out from a meet with a cold trying to hang on to every last bit that I can, and just recognizing, like, this is a much bigger, bigger, longer term process. And training hard when you're ready to adapt is better than pushing it when you're not ready to adapt.
Yeah, I like that. No, good summary. All right, next question. Why does the food matrix effect apply to supplemental fiber but not to supplemental protein? I looked at the little cross-eyed. You just made the little
face. It
does. It does. In fact, that was my answer. But I wanted to actually discuss this a little bit more, because I think, and some of this is probably our fault, when we talk about the complex relationships of whole foods and how that differs from the isolated nutrients from those foods, we just kind of hand wave it away and say, well, it's the food matrix effect. And people are like, the food, what? Is Keanu Reeves the lead star in this particular movie? All right, so let's talk about what the food matrix is and what the food matrix effect is, and go from there. The food matrix refers to not only the chemical and physical components of food, but also their molecular relationships that affect how food is digested and metabolized. The food matrix effect refers to how the whole food, like an apple, for example, influences a particular outcome, like feelings of fullness or satiety, or a health parameter compared to one of its nutrients in isolation, so like a particular flavonoid that an apple contains. And so how this might be practically applied is, if a study comes out or a mainstream media headline comes out and says, eat an apple a day keeps the doctor away. Okay, maybe that came out like turn of the century or whatever. somebody might say, well, it's the flavonoids or it's the tocopherols or whatever it is, you know. And so they try to isolate and they're successfully able to isolate this thing. And now it's a supplement. You can take, you know, apple flavonoid 3, mm-hmm. whatever, yeah. And, you know. And they're like, see, I'm taking – basically, it's like eating apples. But those things are different. Those things are different because the sum of all of the things that makes an apple is greater than the parts. So it's not just the flavonoids, not just you know, the fiber, for example, or in this case, the protein, but it is the complex relationship of the whole food. And so using the fiber example here, increasing the intake of fiber from whole foods, for example, that tends to be more filling. So people feel fuller and they tend to reduce total energy intake to a greater degree when compared to people increasing fiber by supplementing. And the reasons for this are complex. It's not just the fiber, but it's the fact that that whole food that contains fiber replaces or displaces other foods and the subsequent dietary pattern changes. It, you know, people, the same people who are, you know, adding broccoli or like legumes or whatever to their diet, that more changes are occurring than just, oh, they just increase more fiber. No, no, no. You took something else out of your diet. For example, you've shifted your dietary pattern en masse because, I mean, you weren't eating legumes before and now you are and you're doing other stuff. So there's a behavioral component here. Other nutrients in the whole food could be contributory, whether it's a vitamin, whether it's another micronutrient, not just fiber. The way the fiber is actually packaged structurally within the food itself can be contributory. So generally speaking, increasing dietary fiber via supplementation does not have the same health effects as increasing whole food sources of fiber. The one major sort of time that this does not apply is when we talk about lowering LDL, for example, triglycerides as well. People can take massive amounts of dietary supplemental fiber and get continued lowering of those two parameters, which is the same you would see from whole food. But it is impractical to tell somebody, hey, I want you to get 70 grams of fiber a day from whole foods. Like, what? Yeah, it's probably not going to happen.
I've had a couple patients who were willing to go for it. One guy who had familial hypercholesterolemia, and he was actually managing to get over 100 grams of fiber a day from foods.
Oh boy.
And I was like, respect, but also your toilet's doing the most here.
Yeah, honest. You're the real MVP. That porcelain, yeah. Yikes. So when I think about protein, I think that there is a similar relationship between supplemental protein and whole food-based protein for some outcomes of interest, but not all outcomes of interest. So muscle-related outcomes, if we're talking about hypertrophy, strength, for example, or signaling of muscle protein synthesis, I would predict that a whey protein supplement in isolation is going to do the same as chicken, right? You know, the protein that's doing the same from that particular sort of aspect. But that doesn't mean that it's the same for all health outcomes. So like hunger and satiety, feelings of fullness. We know that people who get their protein, for example, from whole foods, they tend to have a higher degree of satiety than after a shake. And that's been pretty well established across all sorts of different foods. When foods are presented in like a semi-solid or solid form, people tend to eat less later on than if they had that same amount of calories and nutrients in liquid form. Okay. It's just there are other examples like this. And so I just wouldn't say that the food matrix effect or whatever is either all or none. It mm-hmm. just depends on the outcome of interest, depends on the particular food. And I would even further say that like protein is the isolated nutrient from chicken, and chicken itself has protein, has some fat, has some other nutrients that a supplemental protein doesn't have. And so the reason why eating chicken in various ways it can be prepared might be more satiating or produce a different set of outcomes than a supplemental protein is probably due to all of the things that make chicken a unique sort of food compared to just protein being bland, dispensed from like your refrigerator or something like that. Does that make sense to you?
There's been trials. I mean, one caveat is also you were kind of building in an assumption that they're proteins of similar quality, right? So mm-hmm. if you have, you know, a collagen supplement or something versus a whey or collagen versus an animal protein source or a sufficiently dosed plant protein source, you might even with muscle see a different level of, you know, totally. Outcomes from that. But if it's assuming equivalent kind of protein quality, then yeah, just purely hypertrophy, they are going to tend to be pretty similar. But there have been randomized trials even comparing different protein sources. I remember one paper that was comparing, for example, like white meat poultry versus I think it was fish versus tofu or something like that. And you end up seeing different outcomes in terms of various cardiovascular risk markers, blood lipids, things like that. And so you can't say that, well, not that you can't, but you should not conclude that the different amino acids themselves are driving differences in the patient's, you know, blood cholesterol levels and their cardiovascular risk. It's the whole food item. And so from those foods, maybe if they're similar protein quality, similar dose, you might get similar muscle effects out of it, but maybe some of them are going to have more favorable effects on your lipids and cardiovascular risk and others more unfavorable. And I think that most of the folks listening to this should probably account for things like that when it comes to their habitual protein sources, right? So some folks get really on the bandwagon of, I need all protein, all animal-derived protein sources all the time, high dose to ensure adequate muscle, you know, development. And so I'm just going to go all beef all the time. And I'm like, well, I can feel pretty confident that that's likely from the dietary protein standpoint to maximize your muscle adaptations. But I also think that if you were to swap out some servings or many servings of that with some of these other options along the way, you might maintain similar gains in the from the muscular side while also enjoying health benefits and other kind of more varied nutritional benefits from the other food sources as part of your overall dietary pattern. So swapping out some of that for some salmon, swapping out some of that for some legumes, swapping out some of that for, you know, other things is generally wise, I think.
Yeah, we just cannot assume that reductionist sort of, you know, type analysis that, like, okay, if you separate this one thing from the whole food it came from, that it's going to work the exact same. And we just call that, you know, when we find differences, we just call the reason for all of that the food matrix effect. Now, teasing out what the exact sort of, you know, contribution between structure versus behavioral versus like co-occurring nutrients, well, that's above our pay grade, you know, to speak for every potential thing here. But yeah. Hopefully that was a good discussion about the food matrix and the food matrix effect. All right, next question here on this Ask Me Anything on a Barbell Medicine podcast. What is the minimum amount of sets frequency needed to preserve muscle mass while on anti-obesity medications? Just right off the jump, if I pose this question to you, does a number enter your brain or is it all no. Like initially it's just like it depends?
Yeah. Yeah, the thing that springs into my mind is a similar topic that we've talked about a few times recently, kind of like the bell curve of training responsiveness, right? And so if you have somebody who just set aside the drug altogether for the moment and just all comers who are coming to start training, you're going to have some people who are super freaks. You put them on a training program, they squat two sets a week and they blow up, they get super strong, they get super jacked, they turn into Charlie. You take other people who are much more training resistant, you get them training, you crank up their training volume, their intensity, you have to employ all sorts of programming tricks, and they progress super slowly, if at all. They stall out early, and they get frustrated because maybe they're not responding as quickly as the guy that they see on the other side of the gym. That is the natural order of things. I'll put it that way, right? Mm-hmm. And then everybody is distributed somewhere in between. You're going to have a lot of average responders, some high responders, some low responders. The way I would think about this in terms of anti-obesity medicines is in the same way there's going to be a curve distribution of response to people trying to lose weight. There are going to be some people who have an easier time losing weight and sustaining weight loss. Some people are going to have a harder time losing weight and sustaining weight loss. The anti-obesity medicine, like Ozempic or any of these other ones that are popular, of course, at the moment, will just shift that curve to make it easier for more people to achieve and maintain clinically significant weight loss, right? In the same way that if we took the people who came to the gym at the beginning and put them on anabolic steroids, it will increase their sensitivity. It'll shift the curve in the other direction. More of them will have an easier time achieving a certain level of strength, muscularity, outcomes, things like that. And so when it comes to this question more directly now, how much training do you need to preserve muscle mass while on an anti-obesity medicine? Now we're just kind of crossing these two variables. You're going to have people who have a wide distribution in their training responsiveness. You're going to add in the kind of wrinkle or the additional variable of the anti-obesity medicine that might alter people's training responsiveness a little bit. But it's pretty likely that the freaks are going to remain the freaks, and maybe they only need a set a week or no sets to maintain their muscle for a while. And there are going to be some people who need to train a lot more if they want to maintain their strength and muscle mass. And unless you already have a sense of that beforehand, based on your training responsiveness before you started on the medicine, you're unlikely to otherwise have a great sense of that when you start the medicine. And it's going to be something you can only figure out and determine kind of in retrospect.
Yeah. I'm thinking about like a study design where you could actually like come up with some sort of normalized data, like, hey, on average, this is what you'd need and here's the range, right? So you would have people who are untrained, right? They've not been exposed to resistance training recently, so maybe for the last year or two, because I think we would both agree that it's improbable that somebody starting an anti-obesity medication like Wegovy, semaglutide, Zepbound, whatever, for them to preserve as much muscle mass as possible without resistance training. Like you're going to have to do some. Okay. So then you would just have to stratify. Okay. These people got one set per week of whatever, leg press. These people got two sets per week. These people got three sets, all the way up to like, I don't know, 15 sets, right? And what I would expect to see is a sort of graded response where you like get up to some sort of maximum, like, wow, these people on average are preserving the maximum amount of muscle mass, perhaps even building new muscle mass, you know, gaining muscle mass, particularly if they're untrained before. And then it starts to taper off. I don't know that it tapers off completely where you see a sort of negative, although it's possible that that could happen. So, yeah, that would be the study design, you know, to sort of look at this just from a very simplified view. As far as practically, like, okay, well, great. You guys just neckbearded this thing for 5 minutes. Like, what do I actually do here? I think we can all agree that they're going to need some level of resistance training. I think for most people, preserving a large majority of their muscle mass could be achieved by just meeting the current physical activity guidelines, which is twice per week of resistance training, hitting all major muscle groups using 8 to 10 exercises at an intensity that's pretty uncomfortable at the end. And I think if you just checked that box, which to be clear, almost nobody is doing right now anyway, broadly speaking, the general population. People would do a lot better than what they're currently doing as far as muscle mass preservation goes. And that should be caveated by, I don't think that there is this like crazy amount of muscle mass loss going on with anti-obesity medications in general. I think that is mostly an inappropriately voiced concern. What's really happening is people are losing more weight than they ever would have been able to lose with lifestyle change alone. And there's a proportional amount of lean body mass loss that comes with that. As you lose more weight, you will lose more lean body mass. But not all of that is skeletal muscle mass. It's just anything that's not fat. So water, glycogen, various sort of protein and other tissues, and sure, some skeletal muscle mass. But because these people are losing far more than what folks can lose with lifestyle change alone, generally speaking, yeah, they're going to lose more lean body mass. I still think, though, that just meeting the physical activity guidelines is likely to get most people pretty close to like maximizing the amount of muscle preservation. Some folks are going to need more than that. Some folks are going to need a lot more than that, you know, just because the variation in response. But I can't see myself really recommending that everybody double the current physical activity guidelines for resistance training in order to prevent this, you know, potential loss of muscle mass. I think that would be a step too far.
Yeah. And if I'm working one-on-one with a person and trying to come up with some actual concrete guidelines, I'm also going to take into account what their historic type of physical activity is and what their goals are. So some people, like maybe somebody in our audience, might actually be motivated and they want to be as strong and jacked as they can while they use these medicines. And I'm like, okay, well, we're going to train as if you're trying to gain muscle mass.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll hope to, you know, retain as much as we can. And there's actually a chance you could gain some. And other people who might be like, look, I hate lifting weights and I'm willing to do the bare minimum, just tell me what that bare minimum is. At which case I'm going to, just like I would starting somebody, anybody else out who's untrained, I'm going to start them low and then see how much I can negotiate with them over time. Maybe they find they don't hate it as much as they thought. Maybe they're willing to do a little bit more than they thought once they enjoy some of the benefits, and maybe not. And I'll try to settle out at what's the highest amount that I can get them to that they're willing to tolerate. Maybe that's, you know, four sets a week across two sessions. Okay, well, I'm going to make those two sets per session probably going to make them pretty hard if I can negotiate that with them, and then, you know, see how they respond. And if they find, yeah, I'm actually retaining, I don't feel like I'm losing muscle or strength, then great. Or if they feel like I'm willing to do a little bit more, cool, I might bump you up and try to see if I can get you doing a little bit more. So that's how I would approach it in practice one-on-one with somebody.
Yeah, pretty much any time I get one of these minimum dose kind of questions, whether it's like, what's the least amount of training I can do to like maintain my current strength, muscle mass, or like, what's the minimum amount of training I need to do to, you know, for health? And it's like, I just come at it from the exact opposite. I'm like, well, how much can I get you to do?
Yeah.
Because generally speaking, the more exercise you do, the fitter that you get. And so I want you to do the most that you can. And the two constraints are logistics, like how much time do you have, resources do you have, whatever, and then your physiological tolerance. How much training can you do and still recover from it? And I want to get you up to that point. You know, like, how much can I borrow here? Like, that's what I want to do, to max that out.
Yep.
All right. Well, that is a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. All of the links to the stuff we discussed in here are in the show notes below. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.